I'm Ray Bassett, and today on Scenic Roots, our encore edition, Barefoot Nelly and Company.
I'm just excited. I'm not fearful or dreading the future of bluegrass because I think there's always going to be people that like the traditional side that are going to keep it alive. The progressive people will keep the progressive stuff. I think it's going to rock on and continue, and I'm excited for the future.
The Coca-Cola Trail.
The more I got into it, the more I realized it's all over the place. And it needs to be gathered together so people can experience the same thing I'm experiencing.
And the Rock Creek Stump Jump.
These people are tougher than I will ever be. And I'm grateful to them because this event raises tens of thousands of dollars every year for work on hiking trails around Chattanooga.
These voices and more today on Scenic Roots. The news is next. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us for our encore edition, featuring the best of our past few shows. Let the conversations begin. If you missed Barefoot Nelly and Company last week at Noon Tunes in Chattanooga's Miller Park, we'd like to share the visit that the bluegrass group made to our studio. First, we'll have a chat with the members of Barefoot Nelly and Company. August Bruce, who plays fiddle and sings lead. Carl Towns, on mandolin and guitar and vocals. Eric Bruce, August's husband, who plays upright bass and sings. Elliot Varner, guitar and vocals. And Brett Martin, banjo and vocals. August, Eric, Carl, Elliot, Brett, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Glad to be here.
It was really good to see you.
Yeah, thanks.
So tell me how Barefoot Nelly and Company came together.
My husband plays the upright, Eric, and we played music together around the house, and we decided it was fine time. We started to do a band, and we had a friend that was kind of like-minded, like some of the same songs we liked, and so we showed up to play the Mountain Opry one fateful Friday evening, and he got there before us, our friend, and he had to sign us up under a name, so he decided he was thinking of, what's a girl's name, bluegrass song, and he thought of that song, Barefoot Nelly, so it stuck, and here we are. That was back in 2007, I believe, we started it.
And Chattanooga's home.
Definitely, for sure. We've been here a long time. I guess I've been here now about 20 years, something like that. And Eric was born and raised around this area.
When did you first start playing?
I was 9 when I started playing the fiddle.
Oh, I started playing the guitar about 37, is that right, August?
1937.
Yeah. When I was about 37, and then I played fiddle and then settled on the bass.
Yep. So yeah. Couldn't help myself.
I actually picked up the mandolin. I was like 10 years old and started learning it. Then I went to guitar and so forth and so on.
I started out on piano. My mother got real mad when I quit because I heard a banjo on Deliverance. I was hooked from then on. That was 7 years. I'm 59, so 52 years.
That's awesome.
I started playing guitar at the age of 10. And that was about 25 years ago.
How would you describe the bluegrass that you play?
Try to focus on being smooth. That's the forefront, I think, is keeping it smooth. And then we're not traditional and we're not super progressive. We're kind of right in the middle and fusing those together. And we like the songs that break your heart and kind of make you sad and cry a little bit. So the darker heartbreak and stuff is always good. Little murder ballads, little... Yeah. Cheating songs, I guess just smooth and kind of bluesy, darker stuff makes our boat float rather well.
Definitely the blues.
Who are some of the artists that inspire you, that you just keep coming on back to, that you recognize when you're playing, recognize when you're writing?
That's a really, really tough thing. Y'all know that's a tough thing to answer because it's bluegrass in general. There's just, it's hard to separate it one from another. And that's, again, a fun part about being in a bluegrass band because it's such a small market that we know each other. Most of us know even the famous people. So we're just always pulling ideas from all the bands. But specifically for me, I hate to be so stereotypical, but Alison Krauss in Union Station, being a female, she really was such an inspiration and still is.
Yeah, I was inspired early on by like Jesse McReynolds and all his picking. But when I heard Alan Bybee come out with a third time out and all, it really kicked me in the butt, so to speak, and got me wanting to really learn some other stuff, you know, little, not necessarily traditional stuff, you know, and trying to put in some other things, even though I do a lot of traditional style playing and so forth. But he was really the one that really inspired me to go further, besides Dole Lawson, of course.
If I had to pick a bass player to play like that I look up to, I love his playing, singing, and just him, nice guy, be Barry Bales. I like his playing a lot. I really do. But music-wise, I like Tony Ray. Played in a band called Blue Mafia. Right now he's playing with Dan Tominski. His style, he's got a lot of great ideas. Good stuff.
You know, for me, it'd probably be, of course, Tony Rice. You know,
yes.
That's every guitar player's, you know, who would I look up to? Brian Sutton, Dan Tominski. I mean, he's a great player, great singer. And the list just goes on and on. There's so many influential people out there that you look up to nowadays.
Well, if I had to say one banjo player, it'd have to be, to me, J.D. Crowe, and followed in Earl Scruggs' footsteps. J.D. Crowe and Tony Rice changed the drive and the feel of bluegrass music, and it made the vocals and the music much more appealing. Not that it wasn't before, but it just took on another dimension.
Classed it up. Classed up the joint a little bit.
Yeah.
Yeah, not so slapstick hee-haw.
And then in later years, there's been several good banjo players that evolved from that. Because of that, I'm trying to do the same thing.
How's it going so far?
Well, you know, they hired me. That's a step.
he's not very evolved.
I've got a job anyway.
As you mentioned, bluegrass, it's such a small community. And that community endures generation after generation, passed down from generation after generation. What do you see in the audiences who turn out to your music today? What do you see of the future of bluegrass?
The future is what everybody wants it to be. A lot of people worry about the youth dying out, but I think those people that are worried are not at the right events, because the youth is well involved and they're making their own mark on it too. So, you know, a lot of our shows, we look out and we see a lot of the older crowd that can appreciate our music, but a lot of the younger crowd is also represented there too. So I'm just excited. I'm not fearful or dreading the future of bluegrass, because I think there's always going to be people that like the traditional side that are going to keep it alive. The progressive people will keep the progressive stuff. I think it's going to rock on and continue, and I'm excited for the future.
Bluegrass has a bright future.
Bluegrass lives.
And here in Chattanooga, when you've got somebody like Cindy Pinion that's just knocking down doors, powerhouse, keeping all these events for all of us bluegrass players to play, she's keeping it alive, you know, like Fletcher Bright, both of them. I always called Fletcher the godfather of bluegrass in this area, and Cindy Pinion is definitely the godmother, the queen of bluegrass. Really thankful for all the opportunities. And we're going to be playing her festival this fall down at Chickamauga, down at the Mountain Cove Farm. She puts on two great festivals there a year. I don't know, and, you know, Noon Tunes doing what they're doing and inviting us to play just really shows me that bluegrass is loved here in Chattanooga. Maybe not the traditional side as much. Chattanooga definitely loves its fusions, its acoustic fusions, which I love too. It's fun to see what all happens, but Chattanooga is definitely a really, really great town for us to be in. And now these fellas, they're from, some of them, Brett drove from Auburn, Alabama to be up here, Lochapoca specifically.
That explains everything.
I've already started Auburn jokes.
I had a rag on
him.
There's a tremendous amount of bluegrass down in Alabama, but there's not as many places for them to play, organized things.
The market's just not there like it is.
Not yet, but I'm looking forward to that, because people like Brett, with some property, you could have a great festival down there. No pressure.
Yeah, work on that.
But, yeah.
Will you hire us to play? Will you hire us to play your festival, Brett?
Yeah. I can take
that. When you get it together, we'll have you on about that, too.
Okay, I appreciate it. Yeah, I figure about 52 more years.
And we should mention that Cindy Pinion also helps keep bluegrass alive right here on WUTC every week through Richard Winham.
Talking with Richard the last couple of times, it's been really nice. It's taken a lot of the fear out of this radio's interviewing stuff. It's definitely, I mean, for a bluegrass band to be able to say that they're getting comfortable in the radio station, you know, interviews, that's saying a lot for bluegrass in our area.
Well, thank you for being so comfortable that you could all come on out here and have a conversation and play some songs. August, Eric, Carl, Elliot, Brett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
In a moment, a few songs from Barefoot Nelly and Company. The conversations you hear on Scenic Roots are just one example of the power of local on WUTC. The power of local is the power of you. You are the reason WUTC is exceptional, and we thank you. Thanks to your support, you hear the power of local information on WUTC. Scenic Roots feature podcasts with Will Davis, who brings you Tennessee Valley StoryCorps, and our news with Bill McLean. Thanks to your support, you hear the power of locally generated music on WUTC. Cajun, classic R&B, jazz, bluegrass, modern alternative, noon tunes from Miller Park, live in the library, and the return of Richard Winham to the daytime. When you make a pledge by calling 423-425-4756 or online at WUTC.org, you show how the power of local is the power of you. Your contribution helps provide local information and local music that only public radio can do for Chattanooga and the Tennessee Valley. And your contribution helps provide the news and programs you enjoy and rely on about this country and our world. Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Fresh Air, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and so much more. We thank you, because the power of local is the power of you, here on WUTC. Call now at 423-425-4756 or give online at WUTC.org. And now, let's hear Barefoot Nelly and Company.
This is a standard traditional bluegrass number called Prisoner Song. 1, 2, 3.
This next one we're going to do is a good old real standard bluegrass Mr. Monroe did called Little Georgia Rose. She was.
This is one of my originals called South River. There's a tale that's been told from years on back. I love a woman who lived here in a shack. That curse out swept away from where she stood. Two babies came up from the water. One baby stayed below.
but a crack in the ice they stole to me. Two babies came up from the water. One baby stayed behind. Two babies came up from the water. One baby paid the bills. I plead in vain, or you might get swept away like I do.
Barefoot Nelly and Company. By the way, Barefoot Nelly and Company gave $100 to WUTC for our fall pledge drive, and the group challenges all local bands to do the same. We thank Barefoot Nelly and Company for their time, their music, and their support. Just another example of how the power of local is the power of you here on WUTC. You're listening to Scenic Roots. More after our news with Bill McLean. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Chattanooga looms large in the history of all things Coca-Cola, and Larry Jorgensen is quite the guide. He wrote a book titled The Coca-Cola Trail, People and Places in the History of Coca-Cola. Larry, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to talk with you and to share some interesting experiences on the trail.
Well, how did you get into writing this book?
Well, actually, it started out to be simply a feature about a couple Coca-Cola museums. And the more I got into it, the more I realized it's all over the place. And it needs to be gathered together so people can experience the same thing I'm experiencing. It was sort of a, yeah, let's go do this. Let's see how far this trail will take us. And in fact, it's even taken us to a sequel now under production.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. And if we're going to talk about the Coca-Cola Trail, we have to start first and foremost with Chattanooga.
Absolutely. You know, there is as much, maybe even more reasons for Chattanooga to claim Coca-Cola fame than Atlanta. The history of Coca-Cola and why it became what it became is definitely rooted in Chattanooga. Deal with the bottling. Coca-Cola was first bottled in 1894 in Vicksburg, Mississippi. They weren't bottling it in Atlanta. They didn't think that was a good idea until a couple guys from Chattanooga went to Atlanta and convinced Asa Candler, who was making the syrup, that bottling would be okay. He didn't really think it would be okay, but he said, yeah, go ahead and do it. I'll sell you the rights to do it in the United States for a dollar. And he told him, he said, if this doesn't work, don't come crying back to me. Well, so you have Mr. Ben Thomas and Mr. Joe Whitehead, a couple of young, ambitious attorneys, come back to Chattanooga, and they realize, we've got the rights to bottle Coca-Cola throughout the United States. How are we going to do this? Well, initially they took a look at a bottler in Shreveport to try to see if something could be worked out there, and that didn't go anyplace. So they scrounged up $1,500 and started a little bottling operation. Well, you know, where are we going to go from here? We got the whole country. And guess what? The lights came on. It's called franchising. We have the rights. Let's start cutting up the pie and selling it to others. And that's really how the Coca-Cola empire got started. I mean, if you can imagine, you have a product and you have people paying money to be able to go out and make and produce your product. And that's exactly what happened. So it started in Chattanooga. Really, it was like 5 years after they'd been doing it in Vicksburg, and actually they'd done it at a little bottling operation in Valdosta as well. But, you know, Coca-Cola didn't really think bottling was the way to go.
Why not?
Well, I think Asa Candler told Thomas and Whitehead when they met, he said, you know, I'll use his exact words. He said, this is a back alley operation. And he was concerned that the quality and the taste of the Coca-Cola as served across the fountains wouldn't be the same in a bottle. He was really concerned about that. It took a couple of days, these two attorneys from Chattanooga, to convince him to at least let them give it a try.
And beyond Chattanooga, there are so many twists and turns on this trail.
I think one of the interesting ones, which isn't too far from you, is Paducah, Kentucky. The franchise for Paducah was actually sold to a gentleman who the Thomas and Whitehead had met on the incline and talked to him there, and he became fascinated with it. So they sold him a territory, probably 50-mile radius in Paducah. Well, if you go to Paducah, that, in fact, it's in my book, but the history to that bottling plant, it's a beautiful plant. It's now in another life, and you can visit it. There's a brew pub in there, a pizza place, and some other things. And it's just a gorgeous plant, an old plant building, and it's a fantastic history. But it all started in Chattanooga when Thomas and Whitehead met this enterprising young man from Paducah. That's a lot of how it got started.
And then, of course, it took off and it took off. And I'm just looking at some of the other highlights on the trail here. And I'm seeing a Bonnie and Clyde holdup of a Coca-Cola plant in Arkansas.
Yeah, that was interesting. They had actually, it wasn't Bonnie and Clyde, but it was a couple members of their gang. They had kind of a loose gang as well, who had gone to Chicago to buy some guns and so forth. And they say it was from Al Capone. I don't know about that. But anyhow, on their way back, they felt the need to try to gather up a little loose money. And they had planned on holding up the bank in Nashville. That's Nashville, Arkansas. Well, the word got out that they were headed at the bank, so the sheriff's department had everybody on top of the bank. So when they got there, the next best choice was a Coca-Cola plant, and they went over there, and I think there was like $80 in the cash box, and that's about all they got away with. And they did escape and continued on with their trail of crime into Texas and so forth, and ultimately ended up in Alcatraz, but at least along the way it started at a Coca-Cola plant in Arkansas.
And presumably, while at the plant, they consume product and may very well have brought product with them leaving the plant.
That could be. I'm not sure. The gentleman that told me this story was one of the family of the plant owners, and they still own the plant. He did say that when they went in and said, give me your cash, the guy pulled out the cash box, and the trucks hadn't come in yet from the day's work, so there was only like about $80 there. And some checks. The owner convinced the robbers that the checks were of no value, so they took the cash only and left the checks.
And speaking of longevity, there's the 97-year-old man who worked for a Coca-Cola plant for 79 years.
Right, and he's still there. It's in Fort Smith, Arkansas. They have a little museum that his main job right now, part-time, is taking care of the museum. Getting back to Chattanooga. So you had the emphasis coming from selling the territories, but then what else evolved? You had the Chattanooga Glass Company ultimately became one of the largest producers of the Coca-Cola bottle, the bottle that we all know now as the Coca-Cola bottle, which first got patented in 1906. It was created by a glass company in Indiana. Chattanooga Glass started making that bottle in 1916 and became very successful with that. In addition, what are you going to put the bottles in? A wooden case. So Chattanooga Box and Lumber started making the wooden cases in 1917. In fact, the story is told that the two companies would send out their salesmen together and they would sell the glass bottles in the wooden cases. There certainly was a lot of prosperous people that evolved because of Coca-Cola in Chattanooga.
And people who are reading this book, they're telling you things like, I'm going to take a vacation based on the destinations you wrote about.
Right. The book is really serves two purposes. Kind of a travel adventure guide. It tells you places that you can go and you can still see, touch, feel, things that were Coca-Cola. The book tells you why it was Coca-Cola, what it is now, and what it was then. A lot of historic photos in the book. We talked to a lot of historical associations and to a lot of Coca-Cola families in creating the book.
Larry, thanks so much and all the best.
Well, thank you, Ray. It's been a pleasure. We'll be back to take you on the next trip on the Coca-Cola Trail.
Looking forward to it. Thanks, Larry.
Thank you.
The conversations you hear on Scenic Routes are just one example of the power of local on WUTC. The power of local is the power of you. You are the reason WUTC is exceptional, and we thank you. Thanks to your support, you hear the power of local information on WUTC. Scenic Routes feature podcasts with Will Davis, who brings you Tennessee Valley StoryCorps, and our news with Bill McLean. Thanks to your support, you hear the power of locally generated music on WUTC. Cajun, classic R&B, jazz, bluegrass, modern alternative, noon tunes from Miller Park, live in the library, and the return of Richard Winham to the daytime. When you make a pledge by calling 423-425-4756 or online at WUTC.org, you show how the power of local is the power of you. Your contribution helps provide local information and local music that only public radio can do for Chattanooga and the Tennessee Valley. And your contribution helps provide the news and programs you enjoy and rely on about this country and our world. Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Fresh Air, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and so much more. We thank you, because the power of local is the power of you, here on WUTC. Call now at 423-425-4756 or give online at WUTC.org. This year's Rock Creek Stump Jump takes place next month on Saturday, October 19th. Not long ago, Gina Stafford hiked part of a roughly 10-mile stretch of the Stump Jump course. Here on this campus, the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga, Gina is the Assistant Vice Chancellor for Communications and Marketing. And once again, she stops by Scenic Routes to tell us about another wonder of our outdoors.
Gina, thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ray. Glad to be here.
So, the Rock Creek Stump Jump. I had to say that a few times so I didn't stumble over myself. That's one of those colorful names for an outdoor venue. Tell us about it.
Actually, the Rock Creek Stump Jump, I have to be careful myself, it's the name of an established event that has become one of the premier trail running races in the Southeast. It's organized by Chattanooga's very own Rock Creek Company. And it's a race presented in September or October every year as either a 50K or a 10-mile run. I've seen it referred to as, quote, the beast of the Southeast. Mm. And for those who aren't readily familiar with the metric system, a 50K is 30 miles. That's longer than a marathon on mountain trails, on mountain terrain, in mountains. These people are tougher than I will ever be. And I'm grateful to them because this event raises tens of thousands of dollars every year for work on hiking trails around Chattanooga. So I happened upon a roughly 10-mile route that the event uses when I was looking for a new place to hike, hence a hiking route called the Rock Creek Stump Jumper. It began where the trail running event does every fall, right next to Signal Mountain High School. The trail is rated as moderate for hiking purposes, and it's about 9.8 miles long.
I assume this is one of the many hiking trails that begin or are accessible from Signal Mountain. Is that correct?
It is. Actually, the town of Signal Mountain is rich with hiking trails. Mm. The city owns the Rainbow Lake Wilderness area that's popular for its own hiking trails, and passing through that area is the Cumberland Trail. And Tennessee's Cumberland Trail is a roughly 300-mile network of hiking trails that stretch from the northeastern corner of the state south to end at Signal Point Park, which is part of the Chickamauga and Chattanooga National Military Park areas. And then there's also Prentice Cooper State Forest, which is 6,000 acres of protected land and 35 miles of hiking trails. This area and the forest is almost entirely in Marion County, but it does reach east into Hamilton County, where it crosses Suck Creek and goes up from there to the popular picturesque Edwards Point. I think that's why so many Prentice Cooper trails are accessible from Signal Mountain.
Which of those trail networks made up the stump jump route?
It's actually two of three of them. There's a lot of overlap of the southern end of the Cumberland Trail and Prentice Cooper trails. So I chose this designated 10-mile loop that begins and ends at a well-marked access point just below Signal Mountain High School's soccer field. The free app All Trails is where I researched and located the Stump Jumper Trail map.
And so how was the hike?
Actually, I'm glad that it was a lot shorter than the 50K Rock Creek Stump Jumper route. Both that route and the 10 miles that I hiked began on gravel trails in the Shackelford Ridge Park area. I ended up on the Shackelford Park Orange Trail. They have lots of kind of color named like that. And I took this orange trail south, getting onto it there at an arboretum that's right next to Nolan Elementary School on Signal Mountain. So from there, it was pretty peaceful, textbook woodland hike over this gently rolling terrain for about 3 miles or so. My husband didn't join me because he was not up for double-digit mileage that day. So the only hikers I actually saw on that leg were a couple who were finishing up just as I started. They warned me that the insects were out in force that day, and I always assume that's the case. I wouldn't hike in the woods without bug spray anymore than I would hike without shoes. And generally, I went clockwise on this loop that I took, starting at about 12 on the face of the clock, and I go south along the Orange Trail for 4 or 5 miles, picked up the Signal Point Trail, to continue past the Signal Point Overlook to the Edwards Point Overlook, and then the route would continue north back up and over to return to the start of the loop.
And all of that ended up being about 10 miles?
Well, my route was about 10 miles, but it varied actually from the course. I chose to go against the trail reviews I read that encouraged going counterclockwise because doing so would allow you to make a descent. And then you would finish out with gently rolling terrain. But I also noted that more than one hiker had reported the route was really easy to lose at the last half of the trail if you went counterclockwise. And to me, getting lost is a much bigger problem than having to climb. So I intentionally began my loop with that trickier half up front where it was easier to lose the trail. Some of the markings weren't as prominent, but again, I used the All Trails app on my phone to basically check my location in real time, and that came in handy several times when I couldn't clearly identify which way to go.
Doesn't that assume that you have your cell phone on you and Wi-Fi?
Yeah, exactly. And I want to emphasize that that is much more the exception than the rule in my experience as a hiker. Also, on the day I took the hike, it was hot and humid, and that combination made for a heat index of about 98 degrees. So I made a game time decision to cut some mileage and take a detour because of the brutal temperatures and because of the direction I was going. I knew there was a steady up waiting for me on the last half of that loop. And the reason I want to emphasize that is because I know myself, I'm not always as willing to assess and make a change as I should be if I've gotten it in my head that I want to complete X or Y. But I need to remind myself and other people too that it's important to be smart about taking your circumstances into account and changing plans when you should.
So, where did you end up finishing?
Well, I made it to the Edwards Point Overlook, which was about halfway around this loop route. From there, I found the Prentice Cooper Yellow Trail, and I took it for an almost diagonal retreat back toward my start point. So, in the end, I got in 10 miles, and I had made a prudent decision about where they were, so I felt good about that.
Gina Stafford, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ray.
The conversations you hear on Scenic Routes are just one example of the power of local on WUTC. The power of local is the power of you. You are the reason WUTC is exceptional, and we thank you. Thanks to your support, you hear the power of local information on WUTC. Scenic Routes feature podcasts with Will Davis, who brings you Tennessee Valley StoryCorps, and our news with Bill McLean. Thanks to your support, you hear the power of locally generated music on WUTC. Cajun, classic R&B, jazz, bluegrass, modern alternative, noon tunes from Miller Park, live in the library, and the return of Richard Winham to the daytime. When you make a pledge by calling 423-425-4756 or online at wutc.org, you show how the power of local is the power of you. Your contribution helps provide local information and local music that only public radio can do for Chattanooga and the Tennessee Valley. And your contribution helps provide the news and programs you enjoy and rely on about this country and our world. Morning Edition, All Things Considered, Fresh Air, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, and so much more. We thank you, because the power of local is the power of you, here on WUTC. Call now at 423-425-4756 or give online at WUTC.org. You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. Our show is produced by Haley Solomon, Carly Dodson, and Will Davis from the studios of WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Follow us on Twitter at ScenicRoots423 and email us at ScenicRoots423@gmail.com. Also, follow WUTC on Facebook and Instagram and listen online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. We're back tomorrow at 3 p.m., and we leave you with J.D. Simo playing Wednesday night at Songbirds in Chattanooga. Join us again next time for Scenic Roots.